This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM and webcasting at kcrw.com.
From KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
Bush's big Katrina speech, a Republican New Deal, or too little, too late. Plus, the John Roberts hearings end. Shoo-in or smackdown? Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for Fortune magazine and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center, coming to you from San Francisco today. Joining me on the left side of the political spectrum from our Santa Monica headquarters is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the Los Angeles Times. On the right today from Washington is special guest John O'Sullivan, who is editor-at-large of National Review. A special welcome to you, John O'Sullivan.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
And joining us in the fourth dimension of political time and space, as always, from our Santa Monica mothership, as well as Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. Welcome all from across the country and across the political spectrum. A very big development as the week ended and as we go to air. George Bush, after several false starts, according to critics, in terms of the way he has managed the post-Katrina crisis and tragedy, made a major address to the nation from New Orleans in the field Thursday night, laying out a set of ideals for Reconstruction, calling for enormous amounts of money, laying out the terms and conditions under which he said New Orleans would be rebuilt, and generally both trying to offer both substance for the crisis and also do himself a little bit good politically in terms of what the fallout has been since this comes on the heels of his approval ratings being the lowest they've been in his presidency. John O'Sullivan, why don't we start with you? In the in what I would imagine would be generally the president's camp, did he acquit himself well on Thursday night? And what did you make of it?
I thought it was a good speech, considered as a speech, and I'm a former speechwriter. I thought it was well put together. I thought that the massive extra spending programs were sort of inevitable and even legitimate in the sense that everybody recognizes this kind of emergency does require state spending to rescue people who, through no fault of their own, have suddenly seen their lives destroyed. I think that if he were less of a big spender, and this is the conservative case against Bush, he would have made it clear that some of that federal spending, some at least, should be financed by offsetting cuts elsewhere, because under this presidency and with the support of both parties, the federal government has been on a spending roll, and we are in danger of really running into serious economic difficulties as a result. And that's my main point. I've got some other things to say about racism and so on, but maybe Bob and the others would like to talk first.
Let's get Bob in first. Bob, talk about the speech. And I know also those who, at least as we went to air on Friday, weren't near the television. President also made a follow-on address or remarks at National Cathedral today. Tell us about that, Bob, and what you think Together It All means where we are.
Well, the president actually went further today, Friday, at the National Cathedral. And first of all, there was Bishop T.D. Jakes from Dallas, who has a 30,000-member church, and he made a very strong statement. He said we can't be walking past the ghetto on our way to the Mardi Gras, and he called on the nation to address the issues of race and poverty. And Bush gave a really quite strong speech. And, you know, if he's going to stick to it, it's quite a mandate to address something that Republicans have certainly since Dwight Eisenhower refused to address, maybe a little bit with Richard Nixon, which is the existence of race and poverty as the major problems haunting America. I do want to say something about the end of conservatism as we've known it. I think it's over now. We have a $333 billion deficit driven up by stupid tax cuts and the war in Iraq. And now the conservative estimate from the White House today is it's going to cost at least $200 billion. They say $200 billion and beyond, and they don't see any other programs that can be cut. So we're talking about a budget deficit of at least $533 billion projected by the White House right now. This is big government with a vengeance. I personally welcome it if the money is going to be spent to really address the questions of poverty and race in America, which we have been confronted with maybe through divine intervention with this hurricane. I don't know. But certainly it's about time we addressed it. And I think we should have a lively discussion about how that money is spent so it really gets to the poor.
Ariana?
Well, not just a lively discussion about how it's going to be spent, but some real accountability of the kind that we haven't had in Iraq, for example. The Iraq reconstruction is continuing without any accountability, despite demands by some in Congress for a Truman-style committee. I think it's imperative that the Democrats demand accountability, and so should fiscally responsible Republicans. This is not, again, about right or left. It's about saying that we don't want the same people who brought us the fraud and corruption of the reconstruction process in Iraq to bring us the same process in New Orleans. And yet here we have again Halliburton being given immediately a multi-million dollar contract for New Orleans in the same way they keep being given contracts in Iraq despite the fact that they keep overbilling the Pentagon and being charged for it. So that same process of cronyism and lack of accountability will proceed in New Orleans unless there is some real demand for something different. And, you know, the whole speech had that same tone of so many of other speeches the president has given on Iraq, including one almost identical phrase. George Bush yesterday, he said, "We will do what it takes. We will stay as long as it takes." And George Bush in November 2003 on Iraq, "We will do what it takes. We will not leave until the job is done." These kind of phrases are getting really tired because there comes a moment when choices have to be made and when you have both the president and Democrats and Republicans saying we don't know what to cut, that's ridiculous. We do know what to cut. We can cut some of the spending in Iraq. We can cut some of the pork in the budget, over $24 billion alone in the highway bill. And we can also take back, you know, the tax cuts. There's a lot we can do, and it's time for some real responsibility from both parties.
You know, one thing that sure, Ariana, John, hold on just because I want to get in for a second,
sure.
We will do what it takes must focus group well. I think that's one thing that accounts for it to being there. My own reaction to the speech was interesting just because I actually was on a plane flying from New York to San Francisco when it was done. And when I landed, it was on my BlackBerry, you know, as these releases go out. And so I actually read it first before I saw it then, you know, when I got to my hotel and it was replayed on Larry King. And when you read the speech, I actually thought, just as a matter of speechcraft, and John O'Sullivan, former speechwriter, and I've done some of this myself, you know, as a matter of speechcraft, I actually thought it was wonderful. I thought the tonality, I thought the whole crafting of it, which I assume Michael Gerson, the very talented top Bush communications and speech writing person, his hand had to be all over that. And so I admired it enormously as a matter of speechcraft and setting the right tone, except I thought, wouldn't it have been great if this had been on day three, not sort of 2 weeks later? Then when I saw Bush on the television, I had this kind of toxic reaction of how awful it was to see this kind of pseudo event staged, in my view. And I know, I'm sure that that for those who were ardent Bush supporters, this is one of those Rorschach tests where for people who love Bush, they will see that speech and it will reaffirm all that they like about the man. And for those of us who are deep Bush skeptics, you not when you read the speech as I did, but then when you see him on the TV, it just looks like this total staged attempt to sort of get back in the game at the zenith of his or at the low point of his the nadir of his presidency. And it made me almost mad to hear, maybe in the way Ariana's talking about, the kind of that when you see the kind of some smirks and certain facial tics and other things in a way that I don't know, I found enormously off-putting, and I just wanted to share that, guys.
John? Matt, you're confirming that Bush drives people mad, and it's greatly to Bush's advantage, because when people like you, you know, have this toxic reaction to him, as you say, that's not shared by most Americans. They don't feel that way about him, and therefore they listen to what he says, and by and large they will have liked what he said in this speech. Now, they will have liked it more than I liked it, as you sort of guessed, that there's a lot about spending here, and I think that's inevitable, and to a degree right, but the fact is, Ariana here and I are on the same side. There's a great deal in the budget that could be cut to pay for this. By the way, I don't think I'd cut what she'd cut and vice versa, but that's another matter. But I do want to say something quick about
the racism. Would you roll back some tax cuts at this point? I mean, we are
No, because the tax cuts, Matt, are trivial compared to the vast increase in spending that's occurred in the past 5 years. And the tax cuts are also responsible for the fact the economy has been recovering and has done very well in this period at a time when it might have been languishing as people feared it would in the early part of the Bush administration. So I favour the tax cuts. But let's look at racism for a second. It's not difficult for a Republican president to criticise the historical legacy of racism in New Orleans, because for 110 of the 140 years since the end of the Civil War, it was the Democrats who were in charge in that part of the world. So it's easy for a GOP guy to say that. Having said that, it's not true to say that the treatment of people during the Katrina and its aftermath was the result of racism. That's just a libel on the people there, the American people, and even on the not very efficient state and local authorities whose task it was to save them.
You know, just as a point of fact, before, and we've only got a couple minutes before we need to break, but the tax cuts, John, just as a factual matter, I think you're wrong. The tax cuts have cut federal revenue from about $300 billion a year where they would be otherwise. That's not the amount that Bush spending has increased. And the Bush spending, even with Bush's increases, he is way below the levels that Ronald Reagan spent when he ran the federal government, than George Bush Sr. spent when he ran the federal government. So the idea that we're still talking about eliminating the estate tax, and maybe Republicans are saying, oh, let's wait a month to see if things cool off on this Katrina business, while we're getting to levels of deficits that would even upset Bob Scheer, who might not ordinarily care about that. It is crazy to talk about sending another $200 billion out the window for Katrina and cutting taxes for people at the top.
And again, the same flaws in Bush's speech that we had really for ever since 9/11, except for the first couple of speeches when he talked about sacrifice from everybody, were seen also yesterday. There was no call for sacrifice. There was no call for a sense that we're all in this together. We all need to give something, including the very rich who've gotten so much from this administration. And that's really what's lacking. That's why, as a senior Republican official is quoted in the New York Times on Friday saying, we're not sure he knows what he is getting into. And there's so much skepticism in his own party right now about whether he does. This is so much about rebuilding his own presidency, more than rebuilding New Orleans. And the proof of that is that who is in charge of it but Karl Rove. Karl Rove is trying to take this disaster and turn to another opportunity for a lot of the pet projects of this administration, a lot of the pet shibboleths. I mean, look at what they're doing, the Davis-Bacon Act, to wages, to a lot of the things that they've always believed they're trying to implement right now, instead of actually looking at what is not working. And they will only be able to succeed if the Democrats allow them to.
Bob Scheer, last
Rove,
word.
Halliburton,
hold on, John. I just want to give Bob Scheer a last word, because he's been he missed a shot before we break. Bob Scheer, last word on this one.
Very kind of you, Matt. I just want to assure you that I don't like deficits if I'm paying for them, and I want to tell you, even lefties like me do pay quite a bit in taxes. And in general, most of my taxes go to for programs that I don't support, including the war in Iraq. So when something comes along where we have a chance to better feed and clothe and educate people, yes, I do support it. But I think the idea that somehow Republicans don't like to tax and spend, or even centrist Democrats, is utter nonsense. They've wasted a great deal of our tax money. And the only other point I want to make is that the poverty, the success of George Bush that was just mentioned by John, did not extend to the poor, who increased by 17%. And the Census Bureau figure figures show an increase of every single year people in poverty under Bush. And last year, 1.1 million more people were added to the poverty rolls. And it's not just New Orleans. New Orleans showed us one city. It could have been South Central L.A. It could have been, I remember when the Bronx went down the tubes under Democrats and Republicans, and no one seemed to care that a whole borough of the great city of New York just disappeared. So the poor have been ignored under Democrats and Republicans ever since FDR, I dare say.
Just ahead, the truth about John Roberts. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center in San Francisco today. Bob Scheer is in Santa Monica on the left. Special guest John O'Sullivan, editor-at-large of the National Review, joins us from Washington on the right, and Arianna Huffington, also in Santa Monica and somewhere beyond. Why don't we move on to, obviously we'll be watching the Katrina fallout in the days ahead. John Roberts wrapped up his Senate confirmation hearings this week, and it looks like he didn't have a glove laid on him. John O'Sullivan, did he make it? Is he a shoo-in, or is there a surprise still to come?
I think he's a shoo-in because he was always going to be if he didn't make mistakes. You see, in effect, we now have a new game here. The Democrats have made it plain that they will filibuster if they get any kind of backing from public opinion for resistance to a new nominee. That means that if the nominee makes no mistakes, they don't get to filibuster and the Republican majority gets its man in. Roberts didn't make a single mistake the whole time, and he left the Democrats completely frustrated. On the other hand, in my view, the loser is honest public debate, because on these occasions, nobody says what they really think, and we never get a genuine class of opinions.
Well, that's actually an interesting point, John. I wonder, Bob, if you want to take it up, or Arianna. Just the whole, when I've watched excerpts, I haven't seen the whole, the whole volume of the hearings, but whenever you watch excerpts, it's so clearly this kabuki dance where, the senators are making their speeches that are, questions, their speeches disguised as questions, and he's artfully deflecting them while demonstrating reasonableness and empathy and his smarts, etc. Do we really learn anything from this, Bob?
Well, I agree with John. I think this is an example of political manipulation, and if you can do it and get away with it, not be held accountable for your positions, not define your positions, it's obviously easier to get in. And here's a guy who, if I understand it correctly, presented himself as a slick lawyer who didn't believe in anything, came in the Reagan administration. Those are the guys in power. He positioned himself. He advanced their arguments. When he went to a law firm, you ask him to be pro-gay rights, he'll help you there. You want him to be anti-gay, he'll help you there. I guess he'd work for any government in the world, for any cause. I mean, there wasn't any indication of real principle or integrity here, and everybody applauded that. Oh, well, we finally have a moderate. We don't have one of those crazy conservatives. And then the argument is he really a wild, fanatical conservative hiding behind this sleazy lawyer posture? And then we're supposed to be grateful. No, he's really a sleazy lawyer and not, or a hired gun and not a fanatic. But I agree with John that we never got any explanation of his view of the Constitution other than it would be so broad as to accommodate any critic on that committee, and yet so conservative and literal that the people who put him up for nomination shouldn't freak out. So, yes, it was a political game, and we learned very little.
Arianna, sleazy seems a bit harsh, isn't it? Is Bob calling John Roberts a sleazy lawyer? Is he sleazy?
I just meant in the sense he'd work for anyone, a buck determines his conscience, and that's really how he presented himself.
The bottom line is that he ran out the clock. I mean, clearly that was his intention, to make no mistakes, to give that impression of modesty, and answer all questions competently and not make any mistakes. And in a way, the kind of questioning that somebody, especially like Joe Biden, engaged in, with this incredible focus on minor details instead of big principles, and with his constant intention of speaking more than Robert spoke. I mean, there are quite a few people who actually calculated how much Biden spoke compared to Roberts, and gave exactly that sense that Matt talked about, of a kabuki theater, of grandstanding, of people basically who were disconnected from their realities and the problems in this country.
Well, I wonder if we can it's worth just spending a minute on the political culture that this represents, because is it unreasonable to expect a more honest debate? I mean, Robert Bork, for example, who had a huge written record, deeply intellectual guy, considered a very serious legal scholar, as well as, you know, more on the obviously on the extreme side or more aggressive side of the conservative interpretation of many of these issues. And there, you saw what happened when somebody had the dreaded paper trail, but who actually had explained his views on a lot of things and was prepared to defend them, even in a very curmudgeonly and often, almost hostile way. And boom, you know, the lesson is clear, right? If you want to be on the Supreme Court, for goodness sake, don't do that.
Matt, I know Bob Bork well. I don't think in the slightest he's extreme. What he is very clear and honest and principled. And when the thing which damned him was that he was asked, did he believe that there was a right to privacy in the Constitution? And he said no, he didn't think there was. He made it plain that he was not against the concept of a right to privacy or against privacy. He simply didn't think it existed in the Constitution. And that finished him. The contrast, on the other hand, in this kabuki theatre, the extraordinarily kind of solemn way in which someone like, I think it's Dianne Feinstein, said, when you said here that lawyers, that it's not necessarily a social advance to turn homemakers into lawyers, wasn't that a terrible attack on women's rights? And obviously it was a kind of lighthearted joke between colleagues, and by the way, a perfectly defensible position.
Bob?
Well, what am I supposed to say? We still don't know who this guy is, and he may shape the life of our country for the next, 30, 40 years. So it's pretty scary. And then we'll have to look at the next person appointed and see where the court's going. I mean, the fact is we have a right to have answers to some of these questions. They deliberately picked a guy who was not very exposed, had only been on the bench for 2 years. And I found some of his positions absolutely outrageous. I don't know why you said they didn't lay a glove on him. I thought when Leahy went after him on whether Congress has the right to end the war, as well as declare a war, I thought his position was absurd and waffling on that. I thought his position on gay rights was absurd. Oh, I just did it to help, and I would do it. Well, would you help people want to throw gays in jail as well as let them free or kill them or not? I mean, these are real issues about human rights and human dignity. They're not kidding around issues. The same thing is true, obviously, of choice issues. The guy, you know, said, oh, I'm just a wonderful Catholic. Well, does that mean that you would be subject to the pressure of the Catholic Church that said politicians like John Kerry couldn't take communion? So there are real issues about separation of church and state, integrity, civil rights, the role of government. And this guy ducked them all, and that's why he was picked. It was very clever on the part of the Bush administration. They must know something that those who are reassured by these hearings don't know. They must have been told this guy is a secret or is going to be a more militant conservative once on the bench, and we'll find out.
Before I get Arianna in, then, Bob, let me ask you just quickly two questions. Does that mean you would, if you were in the Senate, you would vote against him? And also, do you think that the way he approached these hearings was different than Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Stephen Breyer?
Well, let me just answer the first question. I would vote against him just because he would not explain the position on torture, and he did not was not clear on that. And this whole thing that you're just giving, you know, the whole amorality of lawyers, I'm sorry, I know you're a lawyer and I don't want to offend you, Matt, but the whole idea.
I'm a lapse lawyer, Bob. I never practiced.
All right, okay, you're off the hook. But I mean, I don't want to put down lawyers, as the Republicans always do. They do good work. But I mean, the fact is that, you know, we're talking about shaping the country, and we're talking about the future of the United States and how we regard, you know, for this guy to have not been for civil rights and not understood why we had to extend civil rights and why it was a living notion in real time, says yesterday when he's up for a hearing, but you know, his failure to really deal with Kennedy's questions. How could you have said the Civil Rights Act didn't have to be extended? How could you say you're neutral on the question of whether gays have rights to liberty? On any of these questions, on choice, somehow you were there, but now you don't know where you are. It seemed to me he was a man, you don't like sleazy, slick, as I used the first time, slick to the point of meaninglessness.
And Bob, how can you say that these questions should be decided by judges who are unelected and not by democratic public debate elections and congresses. I mean, the real objection here is that what we have is a system in which someone's sent to the Supreme Court for 40 years and they get to make almost all the major political decisions in that period. That is really what's wrong with this situation.
No, it isn't, because, as you know, we don't believe in majority rule on every matter. We certainly don't in question of individual rights, and that's why we have a constitution.
So we believe in minority rule on that, do we?
No, we don't believe in minority rule. We believe in protecting minority rights, and we believe in civil rights. And we want to be clear why a guy who's going to shape the U.S. Supreme Court was indifferent at best, and opposed, which I think was the case, to the continuance of the Civil Rights Act and certainly to any of its expansion, was opposed to extending it to women, is opposed to extending it to gays. So this is a guy who really shows appreciation for what the Constitution represents.
That's actually what was missing from these hearings. I think that Bob gave a much clearer and much more damning account of what is wrong with Roberts than you would have gotten if you had sat through these hours and hours of hearings, because there was so much about Title IX, about this and that, instead of the key issues that Bob has raised, like his position on civil rights, like his position on war, on torture, on gay rights. I mean, and that was what was lost in the minutiae and in the grandstanding of those hearings.
So we hear a groundswell for Bob Scheer for Senate. Just very quickly, John, then we've got a rant.
The opposite of majority rule is not minority rights. It's minority rule. The idea that judges, who are a minority and quite a small one in the United States, should determine all of these questions that were just listed by Bob is atrocious. It's an absolute offense to any concept of democratic rule. And really, the Democrats here are defending a kind of a monarchical system of government, and it's extraordinary that they should do so.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Robert Scheer, about 20 seconds or so, it is your soapbox.
Well, you know, once again, I'm reminded we may not know what country we live in. This in a positive sense. The National Center for Health Statistics released the most definitive study we've ever had on sexual habits in America. And we find that more than half of all teenagers aged 15 to 19 have engaged in oral sex. And by the way, not just the misogynist oral sex that Bill Clinton engaged in, but going both ways and so forth, we're quite advanced. 4% admitted to being homosexual. 14% of women aged 18 to 29 reported at least one homosexual experience, and 7% of men. So we turn out to live in a much more sophisticated, advanced country, at least in sexual matters, than our family value conservatives would like to believe.
Special guest John O'Sullivan. I'm a family values conservative, if there was one. Yeah.
Well, those figures quoted by Bob are actually below the normal advocacy group claims. But mine is an interesting one, because in New York this week, Bill Clinton has had his own little gab fest. And at a session on religion and public life, at which you had such distinguished people as Madeleine Albright and Elie Wiesel and various religious figures, you had to have balance. So also on the platform, he invited Gerry Adams, former chief of staff of the IRA, president of Sinn Féin, and therefore connected with organizations that are responsible for the murders of, well, about 2,200 people.
Ariana Huffington.
Outrage.
Well, while we've been preoccupied with John Roberts, Katrina, and sex studies, the death toll just in the last 2 days in Baghdad was 200. And basically, the chaos continues. The constitution that was approved, talking of minority rights, excludes any rights for Sunnis. So it's about time that anyone who cares about this country really stood up and insisted that we get out of Iraq.
Well, I just want to shine the spotlight on the fiscal and moral insanity that is consuming us when we have the Katrina upwards of $200 billion that maybe need to be spent to help repair that region, the massive amounts we're spending in Iraq, and these incredible tax cuts, mostly for the best off in the country, all of this coexisting at the same time, all this vast new spending being done, all these vast tax cuts for largely for the rich, and still 45 million uninsured, all this other folks, and record scary deficits. It's got to give some time. Hopefully that's going to happen soon, but that's all the insanity we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Bob Scheer, Arianna Huffington, and special guest John O'Sullivan. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is Ray Guarna. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again for more Left, Right, and Center.
Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.